My name is Judy Madison. This is my fourth year at Holden, I guess. They haven't all been consecutive. The first year that I came to Holden in 1980, I was still a married person. So you know that there's been a lot of change in my life in the last 5 years. Growing out of that experience, as I came here to Holden, we would have some small groups, for example. One year we thought we'd get the staff people together who were experiencing separation or divorce just as sort of a support group for each other. So we wrote that on the board. Anyone who'd like to do that, please come. Same time, same place. 53 people showed up. We had people hanging from the rafters up here and realized that we had discovered something, which was that more people were interested in divorce than just divorced people. And as a result, we had that each year that I came back, that group. And then the last time I was here in 83, we had smaller groups and were discussing, and I always was of the mind that one couldn't really write about it. You know, I write all the time and it's sort of hard to stop me. And I felt that divorce was something I couldn't write about. First of all, it was very personal. And I felt that my divorce was surely different from anyone else's. And in many ways, that's true. But then listening to those groups, I realized, no, that's not entirely true at all. And some of the people in the group said, you really should write down some of the things you're talking about. So I gathered up some of their ideas, and the book that came from that got out just in time. It's about 3 weeks old, from Augsburg, and it's called Divorce, The Pain and the Healing. And I think I'm at a place now where I've moved into healing. So that's the background of this particular get-together that we're having tonight. I'd like to just take some of the first time to read with you some of the things that have been written, because they just condense, I think, a lot of the thoughts and feelings that I have had, or either personally or observed in other people. And then open it up, because you may have specific questions or concerns about people that you know or yourselves or whatever. This book, which I find to be attractive, is called Beginnings for the Newly Married. And I wrote that too. And I can remember what that was. I knew I loved you when we talked for hours as we walked or drove, or sat in a corner and forgot others were there. It has not changed. Our best times are long talks.
When did you write that?
I wrote that with effort in 1977. However, that's what I remembered of our first years, of our first year, perhaps. Other people smile when we act silly. Perhaps they've forgotten how much fun it is to laugh at each other and enjoy being together, childlike. I pray we'll always cherish this magic. That was remembering a moment when we were fooling around in a laundromat. You know, when you're newly married, it's just, life is just so much fun sometimes. But what I tried to say in this book, which, by the way, is every poem is accompanied with a photograph. And the photographs are absolutely magnificent, I think. I can say that because I have nothing to do with them. They capture the meaning very much. And in the book, I was trying to say that it's just not all so sweet. And part of our problem with marriage and divorce is that we do come into it sometimes very naive. And in fact, teach our children that by hiding conflict at home or by continuing with these situation comedies and all of that fairy tale stuff that we promote in terms of marriage. So this one says, you did not hear what I tried to say. I am misunderstood, hurt. Help me not to blame, but to speak again more clearly in love. I think you heard in those that communication, of course, is the central issue. I guess it always will be in marriage. And as we moved through our marriage, I was married 19 years, there was a growing sense in me that was a problem. I haven't talked to my husband for days. Perhaps you'd identify with this if you're a married person. We rush through breakfast, flurry through our separate days, run to meetings at church or school, listen to the children chattering, fall into bed exhausted, get up and start the whole busy routine all over again. Lord, I need to talk to my husband. We need to share our feelings. We need to be together, even silently together. How is it that our world becomes so hectic, so scheduled with activity, that we have no time left for the most enduring relationships in life? I'm afraid that we could easily slip into a pattern of house partners who function efficiently, and when the children are gone, find ourselves strangers. Oh Lord, don't let that happen. I need my companion. I need the love of my husband. Strengthen me, Lord, with the resolve to take time to be with my husband. Help us to see ourselves at the center of our family, united, with our children surrounding rather than separating us. Help us put one another first, before community or job or anything else. Rekindle in us the spark of divine love, which ministers to our partner's need and loves him so dearly that we will never be too busy for one another. I don't need to share with you the gradual disintegration of a marriage. You don't really need to hear that, I don't think. But if one has reached that point where marriage is no longer possible, where it is no longer life-giving, and you make a decision to change that, whether it's your decision mutually or whatever, there are certain things that happen. And that's the kind of thing that I'll talk about first, and then we'll open for questions. It seems to me we are always preoccupied with cause, now that I look back. That is the first thing. Why did it happen? How did it happen? Whether we're the insiders or the people on the outside. I argue with myself. It was my fault. No, I'm not to blame. Yes, I am. I could have done this. I should have been that. Maybe I just didn't try hard enough, long enough. And I sigh. I can't relive the past, nor find a simple route through the maze of life experiences, as if there's an easy answer to what happened to us. When I'm tired or prone to doubt, I blame myself, the easy way out. It's self-recrimination, self-destruction, and it keeps me from going on. One of the most difficult things is, I think, sensing that we must feel as if we were right at different stages. What we did was right, because it is such a painful thing to go through. And if the only way one can assure oneself that it was right is by saying that someone else was wrong, that just is such a downward spiral. We probably all have to acknowledge at some point that everybody is wrong, whether we're still together or not, that we all make those mistakes. If only, how often we look back on events of life and speculate, if only I've done it with our relationship, it doesn't really help. Things can't be redone even if we had a second chance. If only keeps my gaze behind me rather than looking ahead. Speculation can't replace action. If only never works. And there is that sense of going forward and backward. We live in the past, and it keeps us from going into the future. I can remember many times, and this would be true in any grief situation too. I'm driving, things happen to me all the time when I'm driving on the freeway. You might want to stay far behind. And all of a sudden I'm just sort of overwhelmed with the past or with the memory or with the sadness. I think it's because in our cars we have time to ourselves to think. And that happens, I've heard people talk about that when they've lost a mate or a loved one of some sort. And that's the way it would be with this kind of struggling all the time, because I think for those first couple of years, I'm thinking all the time, backwards and forwards. You just make a few steps forward, you know, and then an old song takes me back. I remember all the moments, the happiness, the fun of being together, I am again young in our relationship. I miss those days. I can't have them back, but I miss them. No different than the rest of us walking into a high school class reunion and hearing whatever song it was that they played in that year. And it just throws you backwards. Maybe that's a good thing about life, though. You know, being able to go back. Being able to say that it was all right, too. That it wasn't all bad. I don't want to go back or start over because I don't believe in us anymore. I'm glad for changes, a sense of self that I had lost and have regained. Still, there were familiar sounds, dishes clattering, the radio station, and familiar sights, a cluttered desk, freshly mown grass, and a familiar comfortable feeling that the house was not empty when I came in the door. Now and then I miss the familiar. I remember my son. I have two sons. Who aren't here right now, and my older one said one night, it was too quiet when he went to bed. And I said, what did you mean? And he said, well, Dad was always fooling around with the dishes. And he was, from 10 to 10:30, that's what John always did. He was puttering around. It wasn't that they weren't done. He was just puttering around, putting them away. There'd be that noise. And so I said to Ted something about, well, it's different now. Because we do dishes at a different time or whatever it was, you know. And he said, yeah, but I kind of like the noise. And I realized how much of his life had been disrupted. Those were very sad times to realize that. In my process, I went back to school. Not everyone would be doing that, but surely you changed your whole life. I mean, everything is different. And I got so sick of change, I can't tell you. You know, raising children alone and going to school and working and just thinking differently. Everything is different. And I can remember driving down the freeway on my way to class one May morning and just literally screaming out loud, I hate change. I'm so sick of it. That's what it says. I'm sick of change. New ways of managing money. Of repairing machines, washing clothes, eating dinners. Mm-hmm. New experiences, meeting people, entering places alone, looking for someone to talk to, wondering what happened to my old friends. New view of myself, how I've been insensitive, discovering untapped talents, thinking of myself as single, surprising myself with emotions. Life is so unfamiliar at times, and I get tired of adjusting, readjusting, thinking about myself and my life. I long for a familiar routine. Change is exhausting, yet exhilarating. I pause to wonder, who would I have been without this change? I'm tired, but it's worth the discovery. It has been. As you can see, it's an emotional roller coaster. It's up and down. Those of us who surround people who are going through these kinds of change, and you know, in many cases, grief is the same thing. If someone has lost a mate, we almost just have to be open with the question, well, how is it today? Because you can't be sure what the answer will be if one feels free to answer the truth. A lot of people don't really want to know, you can tell. Guilt. I know I was wrong. There were things I could have done, words I should have stifled, times I might have tried harder. I carry guilts about our past, and sometimes they sit like a stone leaning on my peace of mind, ready to roll across my life, gouging out a carefully laid sod with which I'm trying to begin again. I can manage guilt. I can ask for forgiveness. Perhaps even from you, and certainly from others, and from God. I can look at other relationships with new eyes, seeking to change my responses so that that stone might not roll again and grass can grow. New life, new ways, without guilt. But that's not easy. You just have to kind of keep reminding yourself and go to your friends. part of that guilt comes from, of course, that thing which we honor in the church, covenant. And those of us who took that seriously at some point in our lives and made a covenant find it very difficult to just walk away from that. I can remember so well a friend who was just miserable for probably 5 years in a marriage. But that word covenant stuck with her, and she just couldn't let herself break it. We promised a covenant in church for better, worse, richer, poorer, sickness, health, until death. We broke the promise. Yet being together was death for both of us. We were no longer healthy. Today we have another chance to live again. Still, it's hard to break a promise. If something, if you really want to respond to something, feel free to do that. Resentment. This was my worst enemy. Whatever the source, resentment is an insidious load to bear. Sometimes it comes from self-pity or genuine hurt. Sometimes it's a feeling of standing still while you move ahead in some way, you referring to the former spouse. Sometimes it steals in when I think about what might have been. Resentment keeps tallies, wins and losses, net gains and deprivations, 60-40, 80-20. Who has the children most? Where is the piano now? Resentment is self-defeating. I stand still, looking backward, or wringing present-day hands. I must get beyond resentment if I would begin again. And now that I'm watching some other people, I really am becoming more and more a believer in process. That you just have to go through some things. I just think there probably was a magic number, and I don't know what it was, of times when I had to be angry about some things or despairing about something, frustrated, whatever it was. I just had to do it and say it, and the more I said it and the more I cried, the better I was. It got it over with faster, I think. One of the things that we never did in our home was be angry out loud. And that was destructive to the marriage, of course, to the people, to the children. So then when it was over, all of a sudden all this anger was there. And I had a whole new identity to deal with. I could hardly stand myself. But it felt kind of good. I'd bottled it up. I am sometimes amazed at my anger. Whatever has gone before, I'm surprised to find so much residue of hostility and anger now. It is a sign of the investment I've made in your behavior and welfare and how it is so entangled with mine. It isn't over. When it's over, it's not over. People are still so tied together for a long period of time. So you can't walk away. So I found myself very angry with John for various things that he might have done. It was obvious I was still married to him. It still mattered so much. I'm glad for friends who hear me out and for one who gave me that pillow to hit. I remember with relief the anger of Jesus and David and Moses. I can try to pretend it isn't me, but it keeps seeping out in one way or another. Let it go. Don't injure. Don't deny. Separation and divorce are full of anger. So I think sometimes we may get the deflection of that from those who we know who are going through this kind of struggle. And it may not be very rational. It's anger. It may not make a lot of sense. Sometimes friends try it. I understand why they did, because I'm this kind of person too. They tried to balance it off. I'd be madder than heck about something, and then someone would sort of, well, let's look at it this way a little bit, and that isn't really what I needed. I just needed to say what I was feeling. And I put my own perspective back on it later, got it in hand. This is called Never Again. There are times when the feeling rushes over me. It will never happen again. I will never have a chance for love, the joy of newness, the comfort of caring, the contentment of struggle overcome. I will always be alone because somehow I'm defective. I am not lovable now. All my reason doesn't chase away this discouraged feeling. My head hangs low and my step slows, pondering, am I lovable? Will I ever love again? The feeling is failure and rejection. I think both people, no matter what the circumstances are, at some point probably experience rejection. And it's hard to sort of pick up and go on because with all the other changes that are going on in your life, it's hard to keep hold of your self-esteem. Your life is really in such a jumble, so confused. I think most of us are afraid of loneliness. And I don't think it's a problem for individual single people. Sometimes I'm lonely. It can happen on Sunday afternoon, Saturday night, or even in the middle of a crowd. It certainly happens at Holden at times. What matters is what I do. It is not necessary to run away from loneliness. Busy, busy, meet the gang, go to a movie, call a friend. Sometimes I just wait a while and it passes. Loneliness is part of any life. Other times it is important to move out of my lethargy and find company. Self-pity is useless and tiring, and there are people waiting for my phone call or a letter or a visit for an hour. Loneliness is not an enemy, but a moment to be lived. I have discovered myself as I meet loneliness and use it to learn about life. That sounds almost idealistic, but I really do think it's true. Last night there was one piece. Wasn't it just last night that we had the concert? There's so much. And she played one piece that she said was from a romantic era, and I thought, oh, this is going to get me. You know, I just love that stuff. And it did. I just kind of got into it. And it made me a little lonely. And then I thought, now think about this. It has nothing to do with whether you're single or not. It has to do with the fact that Beethoven or somebody wrote it. And that's the way it affects you. Just to kind of get some of that stuff in perspective. Well, I probably never would have learned that if I hadn't been through this difficulty.
I'd be cynical too.
You think so?
Mm-hmm.
Another section, you know, it could be a whole other meeting. Singleness is such a different experience. I'll just read about it. I can tell by the way they say single that people feel sorry for me. Some of them promise you'll find someone again. Others tease, have you met any nice person yet? There is implicit in their words the idea that marriage is better and single is less than. It makes me wonder how always single people feel in a coupled society. I wonder how much the expectations of people having to be married influenced my decision to marry and confused my thoughts about divorce. I'm still a whole person. I still like basketball and reading and snow and dinners out and children, sunshine and my work. I'm not less than, I'm me. Single is not inadequate. It is like all of life, bittersweet and good and rich and full of God, sadness and promise and fear. People need not feel sorry for me. I think the place where that is the most poignant is in the church. For those who have been single, you may, I see some nods anyway. I went to church not long ago at a different church than my usual. I just love my own church. Well, I went over to this new church because I'm going to have to work there pretty soon, and I thought I'd see what it was like, you know, see if I could feel at home. I felt great, and there was something different, and I didn't understand it. And it was after the service toward the end that I realized, hey, most of the people here are individuals. It is true that in this church, 40% representative then of the total population are single people. And one doesn't get the idea that it's family worship all the time. So when you walk in, you don't feel peculiar being the third one beside two others all the time. It was a wonderful, liberating feeling. I'm going to fit right in over there, I think. I don't think we intend to do it. Certainly that old idea of having family worship is it's really hard on people who are never married or who have been divorced or whatever. Unless one has the real idea of family, capital F, the whole Christian family, but that isn't usually what it means. To have intergenerational events and to have opportunity for everyone to come, to get rid of names like the Come Double Club, Pears and Spares. How's that? Some say my children come from a broken home. I'm sad and offended. Our home is warm, welcoming, loving. The decision as parents to separate changed our lives, even disrupted them, but we're not broken. We are supported, held together by God and each other. We're still a family of love. I was fortunate. This book is dedicated to some folks named Tom and Diane. They're wonderful. You know that their door is always open. So I could show up there very often on Monday night, and sometimes even on Saturday night, they stay home. It's wonderful, and I could just sort of be there in hard times, and they just were great. If I never knew before, I understand church now. Church is the group of people standing together at coffee, smiling and welcoming me. Church is a cluster of friends, separated, divorced, widowed, who talk about how they really feel. Church is Tom and Diane saving me a seat beside them in the pew so that I don't always sit alone. Church is the community shaped by the love of Jesus, which embraces all of us without labels or questions, innuendos or fear. Bless the church where I am at home, even alone. We do need to reach out, I think, to those people that we recognize as being alone for whatever reason. Finally, we move into relationships and how that changes with divorce. I have certainly found many people who are in a hurry to have it be done with, including a pastor friend who said to me, "Well, I'm certainly glad you don't act depressed like all those other divorced people do." And I thought, well, that tells me how I have to behave around him. He thought, "I'm glad you don't feel obligated to be depressed." And I think people don't understand it's a long process. It takes time. And we need to talk about it again and again. But I also understand that it's awkward. Friends don't know what to do or say when they love two people who separate. Like children, they loathe choosing and hesitate to say too much for fear of misunderstanding. Is loving one betraying the other? Can both remain in the circle of friends? I've been glad for those who tell the truth of their pain and indecision. Gradually it all smooths out, and we rework our relationships, sustained through hard times of honest caring. There were parties that went on and people didn't quite know what to do. Places where John and I had gone for years together. And sometimes the couple it was usually a couple having the party, they'd make a decision, well, let's invite John or let's invite Judy. And in retrospect, I think it might be wiser to say, let's invite them both and tell them that. We used to do that, and I think it works. And then the couple can make the decision. If they don't want to be there together, they can talk about that. If they do not mind, fine, they can both be there. A lot of times that wouldn't have bothered us. Depends. I have been blessed with a mother-in-law and father-in-law who are just marvelous, who said from the very start, and it was my greatest fear was losing them. They'd been my family because I really haven't had a family. And they kept me married a long time, I think, in a way. And I thought, if this falls apart, I'm really losing everything. But they stayed with us both. And they said, we won't choose. And we don't want to know all that stuff. And John and I, previous to speaking to them, agreed. We're not going to talk about why, that old cause theory, and we're not going to talk each other down in their presence ever. It puts them in a terrible place. So we try not to, and it's worked. And they have been just wonderful to me, and so I feel very blessed there. But some years ago, I wrote, I don't even know what page it's on, about divorce. This was before it ever happened. That divorce divides, but it only separates two. Friends, family, memories, and yesterdays remain, somehow disjointed, severed, yet tied. It is a difficult resolve, divorce. I remind myself, don't forget when you say your prayers, the friends who called to invite me for dinner, to offer a ride, to see how I was, just to say hi. These good people reminded me, you'll make it, you're doing fine, we'll always care, you're welcome here. Say a prayer for each and all who cared enough to give a call. That's really true. You know that when we're depressed and when times are hard, lots of times we don't reach out then. So we have to be aware of the ones who have withdrawn from us or become more quiet and reach to them. That's probably when they need us the most. Jesus told us, it is not God's intention that we should divorce. It is God's wish that we should be one in marriages, internationally, in families, in friendships, even within ourselves, whole, one, integrated. God wants our happiness. But we have not been able to fulfill God's wish. We have lived lives of strife, misunderstanding, war, pain, and divorce. We have failed. Jesus told us God's intention, but Jesus came because we fail. We divorce and turn for forgiveness and new life to the one who can help us and bring us back to God. And so the last poem in the book is called Patience. Someone reminded me that things take time. Emotions must be felt and let go. People must adjust, but we don't adapt overnight. Each new experience, each change takes its toll of energy and patience and gradual understanding. 2 years, one person said. I scoffed inside. As 2 years passed by, I realized the wisdom of experience. Things take time to heal. So now, I open to you comments or questions or concerns that you might have. Let me just say that I think
you
if there
wrote
are...
that book, divorce.
That's me. If you want to meet in a small group because you have concerns about this, I think we can do that and have a discussion at another time. And just linger afterwards. We'll try to do that. Set a time. Do you have questions?
Just one practical one. The relationship to what you said about family in the church, I guess probably all of us have what we say family worship, and probably are intending both the unit of the family and the whole family of the church. Do you have a better word that you would suggest using?
Yeah, I think community is maybe better. I would really strongly recommend not using family because of its narrow, it's funny because it's not true in our culture, but its narrow definition remains the nuclear family of 2 point whatever children and so on. But actually in our congregations, if you're to poll, many, many people don't live in that kind of family at all.
How do you feel about churches providing
singles ministry? Yeah, we could do a whole other session, I can see that. I have a very good friend named Jerry Smith, and she has kind of studied this long and hard. She finds and believes that it's not necessarily healthy to separate singles out and form a group of their own. One reason is that it takes on the characteristic of matchmaking. And the other is that is exactly what we don't need in order to feel whole, is to be singled out. Even the word singled out is. But that if we could feel like it's perfectly all right for everybody in the church to come to the potluck, married, single, children, whatever, that that might be more helpful. On the other hand, to have a group of people who could meet together periodically and start this up every 6 months or so, people meeting over separation, shall we call it that, or grief or whatever, loss, all of those words fit. If you had a grief group and made it clear that this could also be for people of divorce, that would be quite helpful. Small groups, you know, really, they really help.
I think in a death, as opposed to a divorce, the acceptance and the way the quote, church community reacts is different in this life. Since I've been the road, and it's different in this. The death is brought on with all kinds of concern, and people coming and bringing things. The divorce is not and the church needs to address itself too.
And perhaps that's from the idea that we have chosen the divorce and we don't necessarily choose death, I assume. But the needs are the same. I agree with you.
I led a class at our church last fall on grief, and I am divorced. And Dr. Kleinbell said in there, it's socially acceptable to lose a spouse by death, but it is not socially acceptable to lose one by divorce. And I am trying, I'm meeting with a lot of verbal, oh, this is just great, we want to do this, but not a lot of things behind it. Trying to get something started as a Methodist conference for divorce and separation. Crisis line, a place to call when we're at our absolute lowest point, when we're ready to just hang it all in. And I feel the same way about the church. The church is at the door of the, and I'm not putting down anyone who's lost a spouse by death. I mean, that is just as terrible as what we're going through. But their spouse usually died loving them. Everyone is at the door with food and flowers and things. The minister camps on the doorstep. Everyone allows them as much time as they need for grief. I had one friend at 5 months say, you've been like this for 5 months, it's time you snapped out of it. I had a son tell me, it's been a goddamn year and a half, mother, goddamn year and a half. Okay, if no one wants to be through the grief more than I do, if I could be there, I could be there. But sometimes even in our church and in our own families, they feel it's enough, get on with it. Believe me, no one would rather get on with it than I would.
Thank you. Process is process, all right. It takes time. I sometimes think that that it's just lack of experience, that people don't know really what's happening and how you're feeling. And they didn't, I had a sense meeting with people in the coffee hour, they didn't want to inquire, was I feeling terrible? They wanted me to feel better, and they didn't want it to be the issue of my life that I was divorced, so they wouldn't bring it up at all. And that, of course, has just that reverse effect about it's not something we can talk about. It must be shameful somehow. It's kind of a lose-lose, isn't it, when you're on the other end? I think, though, that question of, and how we ask, well, how are you doing, opens up a lot of doors for people.
Here it was sad. How come I'm still with a divorce and sad as I'm for no smoking? How come?
I didn't understand your question.
How come a divorce and no smoking?
Divorce and no smoking.
How come?
How come? We're going to have to talk about that later. Okay?
I think one of the problems is, too, that there's always that period when maybe a few people think, hey, something's wrong somewhere, but most people, at least in our parish, which isn't a close, old parish where everybody knows each other, they don't know, one, they may not know for weeks if anything's going on, or they may not know if people are separated or if people are divorced or what, and it makes it twice as difficult to bring it up because you're not, there are also couples that don't particularly want it talked about. They haven't made maybe even a formal decision.
Mm-hmm. That's
so
true.
There's that gray area, and maybe as a pastor, so I've been a little more aware of it because maybe you've heard that, you know, but you're not sure that this is something we've not discussed yet.
Yeah, and that comes from our idea that in the church we ought to be really good people. And so we don't tell each other when we're in pain, no matter what kind of pain it is. We just want our families to look good and ourselves. And it's not very Lutheran, it's not really very Christian, but we do that. We hide ourselves from each other.
People don't really want to know when they ask either. Like, how are you today? They don't really want to know.
Sometimes they do. Some
well,
people
not
do.
Not in that setting. You're not at the coffee hour with all the people around on Sunday morning, and that's mostly the times that you hear, you know, that you are in communication. And everybody's, you know, how are you today? And of course you're going to say fine, because they really aren't prepared to hear anything.
You take the time with it, yeah, that's true.
It must also be difficult, too, with children in the family involved, and they're grieving for the loss or the change that has occurred. And then you deal with your emotions, and then you must deal with the child's emotions also.
That's
so
very
that
hard.
Makes it more difficult.
That's very hard. And one of my children didn't like to talk about it at all. And so his friends weren't sure what they should do. And one of the big mistakes that John and I made was that we really didn't forewarn our children. As I said, we weren't a hostile kind of marriage anyway. There wasn't a lot of fighting going on, so it wasn't clear that this is what was happening. Or at least everyone was good at denying what was happening, including the children. So to drop that on them rather suddenly was perhaps the biggest mistake we made. And that's one of my regrets. I would never advise that. If you're in counseling, so tell the children you're in counseling. Granted, it makes them uneasy. But if you work it out, they will have learned something about how to work it out, and if you don't, they won't be so surprised.
You've spoken of process and patience and a time to heal. What's your personal feeling or your experience about the healing time required before a person enters another marriage so that they do not circumvent the process of grief for themselves or their family? Do you have any comments on that? Because I deal with that all the time, and I need information.
Well, people are different, of course.
Okay. Is there a rule of thumb for you?
No, I don't have a rule of thumb. John was married in 2 years. And for him, I felt that he circumvented But I've watched other people where I thought that that wasn't necessarily true. And for myself, I was going to school and working and doing all that stuff. I had no time to build a relationship at all. So I think it's probably very individual. And then I think some people have grieved and done many things even prior to the divorce more than others. In some ways, that would have been true for me.
I disagree, but I divorced with my parents too.
Mm. Okay. Andy?
It's a little hard to say, or, you know, to say it right, I think. And I think it can happen in any situation, not only divorce, but also for people who are going through divorce to recognize what that does to those who are friends to them and or the community, that there are some effects from the divorce which affect other people. And I think sometimes that's why people have a difficult time dealing with a divorce situation, because of the side effects, whether it be with children or with, you know, the parties or the social kinds of activities or just other things that were there, which are not there anymore, and so they affect other people as well as, you know, people who are going through that situation.
Yeah, I really think that's true. We have to be sensitive to the observer and to the interested outsider. And I think there can be kind of a poor me thing. It was important for me to invite couples in for dinner, although typically I hadn't done so much of that anyway, just so that people understood that I was still a person and liked to eat. And because one does all of a sudden, if you've been accustomed to it, not get so many invitations anymore. We just set our tables for 2, 4, 6, and 8. And that's the way it is. Holidays or any other time. 3, 5, and 7 doesn't win. And so we have to set the example sometimes. We have to reach out.